Well, we're going to have a lot of prayer so that we can get the courage to show up. Let me tell you this. World champion, Tom Brady, Tampa, great atmosphere. What a better opportunity to step up there and be David against Goliath.
Jerry Jones may think his Cowboys are David when they step onto the field tonight against the defending Super Bowl champion Buccaneers, but pretty much everywhere else, the Dallas Cowboys are the NFL's Goliath. Despite only four playoff wins in the last quarter century, the Cowboys are now worth an estimated $7 billion, the most valuable franchise in football and in all of sports. So today, why a team that has not contended for a generation still sits astride the United States, and whether this season will see America's team actually live up to that name. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, September 9th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. So, Tim Kalishaw, do you know you're around the horn statistics, like, just off the top of your head at this point?
Off the top of my head, well, it's kind of easy. I know, one, I have 500 wins.
Of course. Yes. Mr. 500, I should have acknowledged you at the top as such.
One of two guaranteed Hall of Famers on the show. Not likely to catch Woody. He's in the 630 range. But 500 wins, 500 W's.
So many appearances, Tam. Let's just be honest. And so many of those spent gasbagging about the team that I bring you here to educate us all about.
Yes.
How many years have you been at the Dallas Morning News now?
32 years since the summer of 1989. Came here for the San Jose Mercury News, where I'd been covering the Giants. Left a team that was about to go to the World Series to cover a team that was about to go 1-15. So in terms of win-loss records, it wasn't a great move. But yes, been at the Morning News 32 years, a Cowboys beat writer for 6 years, and a columnist writing about the team for 23.
How different, Tim, was the summer of 89 versus the summer of, let's say, 2021 in terms of how things feel heading into what is going to be tonight the cultural event of the year to date, which is the NFL season opener against the defending Super Bowl champion Tampa Bay Buccaneers? Take me back in time to that point.
I think in the 80s, the Cowboys were enormous in Dallas, and while they had a national following, you just didn't feel it. They weren't everywhere every day, whereas I spent 2 years turning on, you know, any of the ESPN morning fine programming, television programming, to watch, are they talking about Dak's contract today, or are they talking something about Zeke? Which topic have they hit upon for a national audience? And that's where the Cowboys are now. And so obviously, to your point, they open with the Tampa Bay Bucks, America's true quarterback against kind of America's fake team until they do something more than get to the second round of the playoffs, which they haven't done in the last quarter of a century.
But as much as the whole America's team moniker, Tim, does feel like this eye-rollingly unilateral, just like marketing scheme, I mean, there is, in fact, some democratic basis for it, right? I mean, this is still the most popular team in this country, correct?
I think they are, and I think they're the most hated team in America. No matter where they play, Washington, Philadelphia, or especially when they go to like an AFC city that they haven't been to in 8 years, Cowboy jerseys everywhere.
Yes.
They go to LA in week two to play the Chargers. What do you think that stadium is going to look like for the, you know, for the 300 Charger fans? And then the rest of the place is all Cowboys. They have it nationwide and to some degree worldwide. Now, does that help them in any way? It helps them off the field. It doesn't seem to translate to wins very often.
What does make the psychology of a Cowboys fan, Tim, particular and unique, different from the others? Because there is excitement here, and rationally, that does not compute to me.
I think it's just the history that every draft, the Cowboys draft a player, they put him on the speakerphone, and he says, My dad, my uncle, my grandfather was a big Cowboys fan. So I'm a big Cowboys fan. Okay. If you're 30 years old, mm-hmm. you have no memory of the Cowboys playing in a Super Bowl unless you were really on top of sports when you were five. There've been a lot of better teams to choose if you're just going to choose a team based on its winning. But what they did in the 70s and repeated a generation later in the 90s, that turned America's team that Staubach and Landry had built and Troy and Michael and Emmett took it to this new level, and it's never left.
Yeah, and that legacy, Tim, is very present still today. It's very proud still today, and with it comes expectations, inevitably, even if the team hasn't fulfilled them for a really, really long time. So I'm very curious what the mood is around your city heading into this new season.
Anything optimistic about the Dallas Cowboys tends to be based on the fact, well, their division isn't very good, so they can win that division. Or I will give you another one. After they play Tampa Bay, the next team they play with the winning record from last season will be the Kansas City Chiefs on November 21st. So they're going to have more than 2 months of playing teams of their ilk and seeing if they can master that.
And the guy that's expected to carve through that ilk, Tim, is Dak Prescott, who is mm-hmm. back under center. He's back from that brutal ankle injury that we all watched
yes.
on national television.
Boy, and he's hurt. Dak Prescott's hurt. I didn't like the way he fell. He's holding his right leg.
How would you characterize the kind of worry surrounding Dak right now?
Even if things go really well, you can't look at him the same way you did a year ago. When he went into the Giants game last year, that was the fifth game of the season. That was 100 games going back into his Mississippi State career since he missed, I believe, a single game. He seemed so invulnerable. So you just kind of thought, well, this guy never gets hurt. And there are a lot of quarterbacks, Eli Manning being one, who never get hurt. In today's game, if you throw the ball away wisely, you can play, well, it was 16 games a year, now it's 17, and not get hurt. And so at the very least, Dak is going to have to make different decisions when the pocket's collapsing. Do I run? Do I do something? He's going to have to think twice about it a little. And we don't know. I think it's significant that he had the second injury, that he hurt his shoulder because of what he was trying to do with his ankle. And Phil Simms talked about that's exactly what he did when he hurt his ankle. He overcompensated throwing. I don't want to push off on this ankle as the way I normally did. And the next thing I know, I've strained this muscle in my shoulder and I got to sit for a week. And Dak sat for almost a month. He didn't play when the Rams came to Oxnard. He didn't participate in that. So he hasn't thrown against anybody really even trying to simulate pressure against him since the Giants last October. And now he's going to do it against the Bucks.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, Tim, the guy is also playing on this four-year, $160 million extension that he just signed in the spring.
Oh, and he finally signed the contract. Oh, okay, good. Hardly made the news. And he's always said, and people around him have said, he won't be any different. And it's not really that you become different. It's that everybody around you looks at you differently. All of a sudden, you're the $40 million guy. He hasn't been Tom Brady's equal on any level other than the fact he now makes more money than Tom Brady. And so what does he do to show for that? And we've seen it in the NBA. We've seen it in other sports. Guys all of a sudden try to do something that they haven't been doing to justify the salary. And I don't think Dak will react that way, but he's going to lose games, whether it's this one or down the line, and he's going to get criticized for it. And the criticism is going to be very different from what it was when he was just the lowly fourth round pick
right.
who occasionally doesn't deliver.
And the person paying that sort of salary, obviously, is Jerry Jones. And Jerry is a guy that you know as well as anybody, Tim. He's the guy who is the team's billionaire owner and its president and its general manager. So how is Jerry feeling these days?
I honestly think he is kind of, and it's hard for him to do this, I think he's kind of qualified. His optimism has been a little scaled down.
Mm.
He understands this team just needs to get better, get healthier, beat Washington a couple of times, and they're going to win the division because we're not totally sure Philadelphia's competing this year.
Yep.
And there's not a lot of fear yet of Danny Dimes in this area,
mm-hmm.
or Jason Garrett for that matter. So get past Washington and then see what happens. And I think even Jerry, the salesman, and Jerry, the optimist, has since the start of camp, it just, when he says things, they just seem to be scaled down a notch or two.
Would you describe Jerry Jones, and I think Mike McCarthy would probably want to know the answer to this question as well, who's entering his second season as the head coach. Would you describe Jerry Jones, Tim, as a patient man?
History would say no, Pablo. History would tell you that Jason Garrett is the only coach of his first seven in which he exercised patience. He had known Jason Garrett since 1992, since he was a practice squad quarterback coming over from the World League, that this was a special person and he was going to be a special coach one day. And he kept convincing himself through all the 8-8 seasons and all the playoff defeats, it was going to happen because of his belief in Jason the person. So 9.5 years Jason got, whereas Jimmy Johnson is the only one who got 5, and he won 2 Super Bowls doing it before he and Jerry both mutually parted ways.
Consciously uncoupled, I believe, is the term.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
But Tim, you were like firsthand witnessing that divorce, right? I mean, this was your beat. These were your guys. Do you remember what that was like covering Jerry and Jimmy breaking up?
That's not something I will forget. I was the Cowboys beat writer still in the spring of 94. Ed Werder and I had led this team to 2 Super Bowls as co-beat writers for the morning news. And in the spring of 94, Ed and Rick Goslin were the ones at the owners' meetings in Orlando. They're the ones around Jerry for the big blow up and the 500 coaches could win a Super Bowl. I was the one who met Jimmy at the Dallas airport. And there were all these cameras there. It was a Saturday morning, and they're trying to get him to talk with a microphone in his face and getting nowhere with him. And as he walks out with Rhonda, his girlfriend, I said, "Jimmy, I got to talk to you." He said, "Not here." I said, "I'll come to the house." He said, "Okay." As if I am a welcome guest at Jimmy Johnson's house. So Frank Lux and Rick Goslin and I went to his house. And we spent 2 or 3 hours there. His parents are sitting on the couch.
I'm sorry. Why? This is suddenly you're crashing a family reunion as well at this point.
His parents have come to town because they know something is up. Mm. They know Jimmy wants them there. Jimmy is scrubbing his fish tank and and crying, real tears.
No.
Jerry is taking my bleepity bleep team away from me. "I'm sorry, mother," as he, every time he cusses, he throws out a, "I'm sorry, mother," or "mama," I suppose. And we are sitting on the floor, kind of watching this.
You're sitting on the floor.
Of the living room.
Cosplaying the role of children in this extended metaphor.
Probably shag carpet at this point. We are on the floor. I don't think it was hardwoods. And at some point, we decide everything needs to calm down a little bit. And Rhonda brings out a tray of beers, and we decide to have a couple of beers before we even attempt to ask Jimmy questions.
So you're sitting crisscross applesauce on a shag rug in my mind as Jimmy is just scraping what is now the cleanest fish tank in American history.
Yes.
And out come the beers. And then how does it go from there?
The algae is gone. Things are settling down. Everybody's in a little better mood. And Jimmy says, "Okay, you can ask me some questions and I'll do my best." But we already know kind of where he stands on this whole thing and what his mood is. The interview part wasn't as great as the more than an hour long setup. It was a different atmosphere, a different media world in 1994.
You're telling me that that's not the sort of access that you get these days around this team.
I don't think the NFL has a lot of head coaches welcoming people into their houses and passing out beers while they F-bomb their owner and general manager.
They do not, Tim. Not anymore. But I want to get back to the present tense where the fish tank may be gone, but the mess might not be. After the break.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Okay, Tim, so as you've laid it out for us, history would indicate that Jerry Jones has not been a patient man when it comes to head coaches, with the notable exception of Mike McCarthy's predecessor, Jason Garrett. So do you think that sticking with Garrett, did that represent a change for Jerry in that he might then have a longer leash with Mike McCarthy now? Or do you expect Jerry to go back to being the old Jerry?
I don't think the fact he stayed with Jason a long time helps Mike McCarthy at all. I think it goes the other way. I think Jerry says, I kept talking myself into this thing was going to work with Jason, and we tried it for 9.5 years. I don't have any background with Mike McCarthy. He won a Super Bowl in Arlington back in 2011 with a young Aaron Rodgers. That doesn't mean much to me right now. I want to see what he can do. And last year, what Mike McCarthy showed was he could try a fake punt on 4th and 11 at his own 19-yard line. That's what he could do and cost his team the Washington game.
Here comes Tim Sedgwick.
Oh, they're going to fake punt. Snap it back to Thompson, and he runs a reverse. Coming right, Cedric Wilson, and he's going to lose yardage.
Oh, that was crazy.
Instead of just punting the ball away, and they didn't have 5 yards to go.
No.
They had 10 yards to go.
I think when you spend time around Jerry and you do start to think the way he thinks, and I'm starting to get a little worked up about Mike McCarthy's mistakes last year, as if they bother me somehow. Patience he's only made one midseason firing. That was Wade Phillips. But I mean, Chan Gailey got 2 years, went to the playoffs twice and got fired. I mean, that was a completely different standard from Jason Garrett, 2 playoff wins in 9 years, and he was finally out. Jerry is not going to wait 9 years for Mike McCarthy to show him something. He's already had to make a change at coordinator on defense. His first one, Mike Nolan, was a huge failure last year. So Mike McCarthy's got a lot to show.
So with Mike McCarthy basically on the hot seat already, Tim, the Cowboys have brought in help. They have brought in Dan Quinn as defensive coordinator. This is the Falcons' former head coach. This is the guy with a reputation as a strong defensive mind, which I understand. But his task now is to help turn around a defense that was, let's just be blunt here, it was gross last year. It was super ugly. So how much of a difference is Dan Quinn going to make, do you think?
It will be better, but they were legendarily bad last year. The rushing yardage they gave up, Cleveland setting a team record over 300 yards rushing. They were terrible against the run, and that just made it easy for them to be picked apart. So you draft Micah Parsons from Penn State, and he runs a 4.3, and he's a massive guy, and he's going to fix things in the middle. And maybe he's going to fix them to a certain degree. You're still not any good at defensive tackle. Your defensive tackles have to be the start of things. So how free are your linebackers to do their job if your defensive tackles are getting pushed back into their face? Dan Quinn, I think, is a good coordinator. Although, again, I mean, his Atlanta defenses were mostly terrible.
Yeah.
So you're bringing in somebody who's, even though he was the head coach there, it's still, he got that job because of the job he did in Seattle. And, you know, sometimes these guys do really well because of the players they have.
Are you suggesting that the Seattle Seahawks had good players on defense, Tim? How dare you? How dare you impugn Dan Quinn's resume?
They seemed to have a few back then when they were going to the Super Bowl back-to-back years. But so I think they'll be a little better, but they're not going to be good. They'll be average if things go well. And average might, again, be enough to get this team into the playoffs.
I just like how the solution on defense was like, let's get the guy who was the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons from 2015 to 2020. Let's do that.
Let's get the guy who we beat early last year, 40-39, and who, you know, his team didn't know how to defend an onside kick.
Yeah. Well, look, offensively at least, it does feel like everybody agrees the Cowboys offense, Tim, is real good. Like, really, really good. So the issues that face an offense that is being hailed as really, really good tends to be about, like, ball distribution, right? Like, how do you work in everybody when you have three legit receivers and you have maybe two running backs that you feel good about? What's your sense, what's your prognosis of that issue for Dallas?
I think that's accurate. I think it's, is Michael Gallup going to get enough catches? Well, who cares? If CeeDee Lamb and Amari Cooper are getting a lot of catches like they're capable of, and if Zeke is running pretty well, and Tony Pollard will play some because he's quicker than Zeke, and if Dak is healthy, and we presume Zach Martin will be fine after this bout with COVID, if their offensive line is good again, then they become a team. Okay, can they score 30 every week? Because that's what it feels like it's going to take. But when you look at the other offenses in their division, the Cowboys tend to be way ahead of the curve in terms of, I guess, all the skill positions.
So I know, obviously, the offensive line last year was another disaster for this team. I know, of course, when you lose Dak Prescott at quarterback, your running back doesn't tend to benefit from that. Was that just an outlier for Zeke? Is this a bounce back year, or is there something deeper going on as he also is getting on in age?
The offensive line didn't cause him to lose five fumbles. That was all on him.
Running to the left, Elliott is planted, fumbles the ball. It's picked up by Byron Murphy at the 30-yard line. The fourth lost fumble by Elliott this season, and the second already tonight.
That was, whatever, lack of concentration. This season is over. Whatever that was, that was all him. Now, his yardage per carry is going to go down without offensive line and without Dak. There's not much else for teams to worry about. But you're right in that over the last 3 years, he's about 100 touches ahead of Derrick Henry for the most in the NFL.
Yeah, I suppose when you get a tattoo that says "Feed me" on it, you tend to try to live up to that aphorism.
He seems to be one of the players who can handle 20 carries a week and come back the next week and carry it 20 times, but everybody hits a certain wall. I don't think he'll ever be the player he was his rookie year. Running backs in their first couple of years, a lot of them, that's as good as they're going to get.
So when Jerry was asked about tonight's game a couple of weeks ago now, and he was asked about what's it like to face, you know, the Buccaneers, Tom Brady, Super Bowl champs, 22 starters returning, all of that. What's it like to face them in prime time to open the season? He said this.
Well, we're going to have a lot of prayer so that we can get the courage to show up. Let me tell you this.
World champion, Tom Brady, Tampa, great atmosphere. What a better opportunity to step up there and be David against Goliath.
So, Tim, are the Cowboys David? Is that where we are now in Dallas?
That surprises me that Jerry would even adopt the persona of David. He wants to be Goliath in all cases, but at least he's acknowledging what they aren't and what they haven't been for a quarter of a century. I have trouble seeing America looking at the Cowboys as David. I think they see them in a very different light. But yeah, David and Goliath, for this game, it kind of feels that way. But here I'll say this.
Okay.
Tampa Bay was not a Goliath last season. They were only a Goliath, really, in the Super Bowl. They were a wild card team. They didn't win their division. They gave up over 300 yards passing to Taylor Heineke.
That's right.
And Tom Brady didn't exactly play lights out in the NFC Championship against Green Bay. Now, at the end of the day, they blew up the Chiefs and destroyed Patrick Mahomes, and they get to wear the crown. But I don't think it's quite the same as playing a team that went 14-2 and won a Super Bowl.
But just to clarify the metaphor here, Tim.
Yeah.
David does beat Goliath in the story.
Right.
Do you see this happening?
I don't want to show my biblical shortcomings here, but doesn't David have a weapon that Goliath does not possess?
Yeah.
Goliath doesn't have any rocks with
him,
does he?
You're saying Dak Prescott has not done competitive rock throwing drills recently?
I'm saying, what is the weapon the Cowboys are bringing that is the Bucs don't have themselves? Could be CeeDee Lamb. It could be one of their mysterious tight ends. If they break one of those out tonight, maybe things will be a little different from what I anticipate, in which case I will applaud their David-like efforts.
Tim Kalishaw, our first ballot Hall of Famer. It is time for us to now consciously uncouple, but thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you before you got to your fifth year of doing this for having me. I appreciate it very much. finally getting on with the great Pablo.
All right, coming up. Whatever you did for your 19th birthday is nothing compared to what's happening right now at the U.S. Open.
Delicious, meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Just imagine being Leila Fernandez right now. Imagine entering the US Open last week as this generally anonymous Canadian teenager who's ranked 73rd in the world and is listed at only 5'6" and has never made a Grand Slam quarterfinal in your life. But then you upset former world number one Naomi Osaka, the tournament's defending champion, in the third round. And then you upset former world number one Angie Kerber, who'd won 17 of her last 19 matches, to make your first quarterfinal.
Leila Fernandez, who turns 19 tomorrow,
4-6, 7-6, 6-2.
Gives herself the perfect birthday present, a place in a very first Grand Slam quarterfinal.
And then, the day after that, you turn 19 years old before upsetting your third straight top 20 opponent, Elena Svitolina, to make the first Grand Slam semifinal of your career.
Quite extraordinary. When you think it can't get any better, you'll prove wrong.
Now, the overall story of this US Open has been youth, but not since Serena Williams in 1999 had anyone this young beaten 2 top 5 players at the same major. And what was most shocking about Fernandez, I think, was this quality that feels pretty unfathomable at that age, especially in front of a New York crowd that tends to eat its young like starving hamsters. Confidence. Because whenever moments got tense, and they often did, Leila Fernandez would just reset herself and speed up again, hitting the ball early and almost always early, switching angles, switching directions to wrong-foot opponents who are clearly a lot bigger than her. It's this type of guerrilla warfare that she developed, apparently, after years consuming YouTube clips of not just Justine Henin, but also Leo Messi and Isaiah Thomas and Sidney Crosby, these sub-6-footers whose style her father had insisted that she study. And now a lot of people are studying Leila Fernandez, including my own very Filipino family. And yes, this is where I am genetically obliged to mention that Leila Fernandez is not merely Canadian. George, her father, is Ecuadorian, and her mother, Irene, is Filipina. Thus making 2021 maybe the best year in the history of the athletic diaspora of the Philippines, putting Leila Fernandez right alongside the first ever Filipino Olympic gold medalist and the first ever Filipino major champion in golf and the first ever Filipino number 2 overall pick in the NBA draft. And today, Leila Fernandez is gonna play her third former US Open champion in this insane run, Aryna Sabalenka, with a trip to her first ever Grand Slam final on the line. This is all an unbelievably rapid rise in pressure. The kind of rise in pressure that gives normal human beings the bends. So, no, I personally cannot imagine being Leila Fernandez right now, even though she obviously can. But I am already imagining what happens next. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.